I can't do it. We'll do it live.
Okay.
No. We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. Fucking thing sucks.
Yeah. It's the last class before summer and teacher doesn't want to teach. He doesn't want to prepare lessons. He doesn't want to correct any exam papers. And we're just shooting from the hip on this one.
Because this is going to be a single take, we're going to do the whole episode in a single take. So this is going to be like what it sounds like if we never did any editing. If you came to a live taping of the best bits, God forbid, this is what it would sound like. So for better or worse, it's just going to be what we get in the next hour. Go out with a bang.
So yeah, roll the intro.
I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
What did you say?
You are a sad, strange little man.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where each week we pick our favourite scenes and randomly selected from... Damn it! Selected weirdly specific themes. This is your co-host Will, a writer of three films plus a Christmas special. And I'm joined once again by our co-host and writer of One and a Bit films and Three and a Bit episodes of TV, Kevin! Kevin, hello.
Back to one. You fucked it up. Back to one.
Yeah, well, it's one take, so we just gotta roll with it. Simple as that.
Just gotta roll with
it. How are you?
I'm good. I'm knackered. I can't believe we're at the final episode, but not to panic. We'll be back once we take our summer holidays. And yeah, it's been a long season. But, so we thought this would be a nice conceit to sort of like try and do this, see what we've learned over the last, what is it? It's like 4 or 5 months at this stage. And have we perfected?
We started recording in January, and now it's some other month in the future. I don't know when. But yeah, it's weird that we've done a complete season, and it's fantastic, and I'm delighted. And yeah, as we already said, this is just a one shot wonder. This is a episode about single takes or long takes, and we're going to do wonders. We're doing that with this. So,
we didn't know what to call this episode because, like, it's got different terms, hasn't it? If you're in the industry, they just call them wonners. But I think for the average layman, it's like a long take or a single take. No edits.
No edits. And then I suppose maybe I'm going to blur the lines a little bit with the stuff I talk about because I think of something interesting I need to get off my chest, Kevin. There's something I discovered that I just went, I need to talk about that.
Oh, okay. I can tell you already that I've changed my mind 2 or 3 times on what my pick is, and I think it's changing again. But I'm sure you will steer me as we go along, and I'll change it once more before I actually say what I was thinking. But let's go for it.
Yeah, let's go for it. I went and kind of like selected only a handful of films because I knew we were going to do this in one take, so I didn't want to have a big BuzzFeed list, but I actually kind of have an honourable mention BuzzFeed list. And I suppose the way to start the conversation off, first of all, is Kevin, maybe I'll do the chronological thing. Okay, the first really notable, like big one take attempt was by, of course, Alfred Hitchcock back in 1948 with his adaptation of Patrick Hamilton's stage play Rope, which stars James Stewart and a bunch of other people. And how do you frame these? Like, what's a good question to ask when thinking about these one shots? And the question really is like, what does it add to the story? And I think that's really it. Why use it? Why is the filmmaker using it? And what is it adding? What is it adding to the film, really?
I suppose it's meant to be immersive, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. And in the case of Rope with Hitchcock, he knew he was adapting a stage play. And I found an interview with him and he said that because it was a stage play, he wanted to basically bring the audience onto the stage floor and make the film move. Because a static image is two-dimensional. But when the image is moving, all of a sudden it becomes three-dimensional in our mind a little bit. So when we're moving through that environment, all of a sudden that space, we are the audience is in that space with these murderers. And he wanted to make the audience kind of a little bit of a witnesses to the event.
Because he would never, so that's what he was doing. Would never change the structure of a play. If he was adapting it, he wouldn't sort of like adapt it for cinema. He would just shoot the play verbatim as it was performed on stage. Because Hitchcock really believed in structure. And if the play worked, if you stick to the structure with a film, then the film will work. So that was his methodology for doing those sort of stage adaptations. So that was that would make sense then that I suppose he was trying to bring us inside the play, but not change what the play was.
Yeah. But it was a tough thing to do, especially back then, because the cameras were, you know, you had a little bit of track, but they were literally pulling out walls, you know, they were pulling like the sets apart to try and have the camera flow across the set, and they were redressing it. So it was a big kind of like, you know, magic exercise to pull it off. And also remember that, like, you know, it wasn't, they only had 10 minutes of film in a can or in a reel or whatever it was.
I was trying to remember how many minutes it was, actually. So 10 minutes. So he'd have to hide those cuts.
Yeah, you'd have. Yeah, there were several times where he would go and, like, you know, go underneath, you know, have move the camera underneath the crate or behind a curtain or something like that. And in those moments, he was, you know, that's when the cut would happen and you'd reload the camera and start up again. So, yeah, there was always, so there were limited, doing these single takes weren't really kind of prolific back then, because you were limited by the technology. You were limited by the amount of film you could film, but also the actual mobility of the rigs at the time as well. So it wasn't really a kind of a thing that was adopted by other filmmakers until the major one was Orson Welles did it again, another kind of like master, in 1958's Touch of Evil.
See, that was going to be the one that I was going to mention, because that's one where the whole film was sold to me on the spectacular opening shot of, you know, the bomb going off, the bomb being laid and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, when you're thinking about single takes, you have to go back to 1958, like with Orson Welles, even though Kubrick did it the year before with Paths of Glory. But that one to feels like it's a definitive one where the film was sold on that amazing opening shot with Janet Leigh and oh God, what's his name?
Charlton Heston.
This, you see, this would You're be right. edited out now in the actual episode, right? Forgetting the name of Charlton Heston.
We got, but no. We're going to roll with our gaffes. This is just a gaff-filled episode. And another thing I found interesting, discovered interesting about that one is that by that stage, Orson Welles kind of was on the cusp of, like, he was pretty much being pushed out by the major studios. So he was on, like, you know, because he had a reputation of going over budget and going over shooting days and all that sort of jazz. And when the production company had heard that he had spent 3 days doing, I can't remember who actually produced that. Universal, I'm pretty sure. When they'd heard that he spent 3 days, like, rehearsing one shot, they've, like, flipped the lid. And they sent down people and all that sort of jazz. But then they actually discovered that he's been 3 days rehearsing a shot that would have cost him away, like, a ton of money to actually shoot and set up, and more time to actually shoot. So it was actually more economical, time-wise and budget-wise, to pull off this shot. And it's a really cool shot. It starts with this kind of mysterious figure, a timer being set for 3 minutes, and the timer being attached, it's attached to a bomb, and it goes in the trunk of a white convertible. And the unaware driver, you know, takes off in the car, and we follow that car as it kind of meanders through the streets, and then we peel off with Charlton Heston, who's kind of arm in arm with Janet Leigh. And this gently,
whose arm was broken at that in that whole sequence.
Really?
That's why she's wearing the jacket that way. She had a broken arm.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Useless trivia for you.
I love it. I love those sort of trivia. But it's cool. It's a cool suspense, because the move itself really immerses you in the environment. That's what it does do. It brings you into the space of this world and the feel and texture of that world, and more than if you just had kind of static shots. And again, I think a common theme of this is, like, you know, the movement of the camera kind of creates, draws an audience into the world, you know, much more. And pretty much after 3 minutes, the thing blows, and it's a real kind of, it's a good scene. It's a great opening to a film, like, you
it's
know?
A grabber. Boom, boom.
It's a boom, boom. But Kevin, before I go any further, do you want to reveal your pick now, or would you want to hold till later on?
So, you know, when we do these episodes, we usually sort of go on a mad scramble to sort of cross-reference what's out there and go, like, oh, I forgot about that one. Or, yeah, I'm not really sure on that. But you sort of, like, do your mass Google foo and sort of try and cross-reference what you're thinking with what's out there. And sometimes we try to come up with something which isn't what you could find online by Googling. And my pick, I think, no, as we just mentioned, Janet Leigh, I think that my pick is one that... Well, it's not popped up anywhere else in any list that I've seen, but I'm going to mention it now in this podcast. And it's Janet Leigh's daughter, 20 years later, the opening to Halloween. They have a very long opening shot, which is from the point of view of the child, the Michael Myers as a child, as he's sort of going through the house, stalking his sister as she's copping off with her boyfriend for the evening, which is over in about 60 seconds. So, you know, the power of premature ejaculation. Yeah. But they do the whole thing of, like, doing the musical chairs where they're moving lights and they're moving chairs out of the way, and they're scrambling to sort of relight the scene as they're using the Panaglide, which was the very early Steadicam. And they're sort of going through the whole house. Up the stairs, you get to see the first kill, through the point of view of the kid wearing the mask, and then the big reveal at the end where you find out that it was a child that pulled off that murder. And I've not seen that mentioned in any other list of, like, great long takes. And it's another grabber. It's another fantastic opening to a film. So Janet Leigh to Jamie Lee Curtis's debut. I thought that, just as you were saying it, I thought, there's the cue. That's my pick for this category. Halloween.
That's a great pick, man. That's a great. I love the fact that you're picking something that's not, because I've, as you said, I've done the research as well, and you know, it's the same, you know, 15 films that kind of get mentioned over and over again, and rightly so. So it's kind of good to pick something that, you know, is a long single take, but it's not a trophy shot, as you would call it.
No, because a lot of these directors that do them, they tend to do them a lot. So it's the same sort of names tend to pop up a lot, like. You mentioned, I mentioned Paths of Glory with Kubrick, and he does it again with, like, with The Shining, where Danny's sort of going down, cycling around the hotel on his little tricycle. And there are other directors, which I won't preempt what you're going to say, because I assume some of them are going to come up. But yeah, some directors really love the opening, or not the opening, the Steadicam sort of tracking shots that go on and on and on.
Well, this is a good segue now for me. This is a perfect segue, because I want to take you, I want to transport you now, Kevin, to back in time, right? You ready to come
transport
on my magic
me.
Time travel box, all right? Okay, just close your eyes, and you know where you are right now.
Do I need to put on
the
some
steps.
Pants?
I assume right now we've gone through the season, I just assume that you're more comfortable pantsless, right? So I'm comfortable with you as, you know, as commando as you are. Okay, so Kevin, so stay commando, keep them loose, keep them free.
Love
and,
it.
And come with me back to 1975, right?
Ah.
And we're outside the Philadelphia Arts Museum. And
the Philadelphia what museum?
And there's a couple of people here. The Philadelphia Art Museum, right? The
Art Museum. Oh, I thought you said Arts Museum.
Okay. Well, there's that one too. It burned. In fact, there was someone lit a match just at the wrong time and the thing exploded.
This is Skype. Every time we record, I'm listening to you on Skype and I can never hear fully what you're saying. So I heard Philadelphia Arts Museum. Go on.
Well,
sorry.
You know, forget about the arses for one moment. And there's two people standing on these steps, right? There's two people standing here. There's a young lad, he's about 30 years of age, and his name is Garrett Brown, okay? And he's there with his girlfriend, and who will eventually become his wife. And Garrus is an inventor.
Mrs. Brown.
And he has...
Legend.
Well, Doc. He's got a PhD, so, you know, Doc Brown. But Garrus is there with his girlfriend because he has sunk all his money into this kind of like invention that he's come up with, and he needs it to work. And if it doesn't work, he's broke as it is, and he's going to be completely broke forever. So he's at the top of the steps and he's going to try it. And he says, fuck it, I might actually break my neck doing this, but I got to do it. And he says to his girlfriend, he said, run down the steps. And she said, are you sure about this? And he goes, yeah, just run for it. If I fall, you know, don't worry about me. You know, you need to just keep running as fast as you can. So she starts running down the steps and he takes off behind her. But he's got something unusual on his body. He's got this contraption, this harness contraption on his body that he's sunk all his money into. And he's got his small little, like, you know, 8mm camera attached to this contraption. And it's heavy. It's still heavy. And he runs down the steps after her. And as she reaches the bottom of the steps, she turns around and she sees he's still with him, that he hasn't fallen over. And she gets this surge of energy and she runs back up the steps again. And he's panting when he gets to the bottom and he just goes, fuck it, I'm going to follow her. And he races back up the steps after her. So what he does, at the end of it, he was kind of exhilarated. He went, "Jeez, I didn't die. You're brilliant. It's brilliant we're alive." But he took that camera away with him. And he got to the film development, and he couldn't believe what he saw. It looked like the camera was floating down the steps and floating back up the steps. And he just went, holy shit, it works. It works.
Is this the guy that invented like the Panaglide?
This is Garrett Brown who invented Steadicam.
And oh, wow.
This is the guy, and this is the moment. So in 1975, he has shot this bit of footage. And it's worked, right? But he doesn't know what to do with it. And somehow he gets it in the hands of John Adelson. And in 1976, John Adelson shoots Sylvester Stallone running up those exact same steps using the fucking Steadicam.
Holy shit, Garrett Brown. I did not know that.
Yes. Yeah. So Garrett Brown, that's the moment Garrett Brown realizes, oh my God, I've got, this is fucking brilliant. This is a proper invention. This is going to revolutionize. So he kind of gets a few more gigs, and he creates this conceptual kind of
prototype.
Trailer, like, you know, running after prototype, well, of footage, like running after his girlfriend through a meadow and, you know, all different types of shots. And he gets it out to a few people, and it lands, he one day gets this letter back, mysterious letter in the post. And it's a little bit mysterious. And it's from Stanley Kubrick. And Stanley Kubrick says, he said, I have seen your test footage and I believe it's going to revolutionize cinema as we know it. and he said, I am going to fully endorse this and I'm going to get behind it in any way I can. And there's a little PS at the bottom. And he said, PS, there's 14 seconds, there's 14 frames in your footage where we can see the shadow of your machine. If you want to keep your patent, I advise you to trim that, because I'll be able to work out how does things work. This is a fact, right?
Wow.
And he calls him and he said, right. So Garrett Brown had made this thing. He says, what is the maximum height that you can operate a Steadicam at? And Garrett Brown says, can you go low? And Garrett Brown said, yeah, we can go low. Of course, he hadn't tested the camera if it could go low or not. Then Garrett Brown went to his lab and he just went, I have to fucking make this thing go low, because he couldn't make it go low. And eventually he invented kind of a low version of low hanging version of the Steadicam that would run as about, where a lens would run at about an inch from the ground.
Like and a skateboard that became, point of view.
Like pretty much, yeah, literally like 1 inch off the lens is 1 inch off the ground. And so Garrett Brown's specific invention, Garrett Brown is basically going to be the hero of this episode. His invention became the kind of the linchpin for one of my kind of picks for this, which is the Shining, you know, shots. And specifically the one of Danny going through the Overlook Hotel when he's, you know, on his peddling trike. That big wheel. on his trike. And it always
sounds
incredible.
Sometimes like we have scripted the episodes where we're setting each other up. And it's like, no, it's just, it naturally sort of just all sort of comes together. So it's funny that just mentioned that and then it goes straight into what you were saying. That's amazing.
Yeah,
I never knew any of that.
It's perfect. It's amazing. Oh, man, wait, this guy was really blew my mind discovering this guy, Garrett Brown, like, you know, because what I love about why, okay, it raises the question to Steadicam, right? It basically opened up. The reason he did it was because he wanted to be a filmmaker himself. And all he had was, he had a dolly, this big, horrible, ugly dolly, and he couldn't move it around it, and he was sticking his small camera on it. He just went, it's so stupid. He said, why? And his dad was an inventor, actually. And he was folk singer and all this sort of stuff.
Ever see the, in The Exorcist, where they do that sort of, you think it's a Steadicam shot, where they're going up the stairs, of the house to the bedroom, and the camera is what you think, like steady camming up behind them. But what they had to do, because it hadn't been invented yet, they had like the cameraman sitting on like a swing, and you had all these winches, and the people were like winching him up the stairs in order to be able to track up the stairs after, I think it was Ellen Burstyn, without having any tracks on the steps. So the things that they had to do in order to replicate something which hadn't been invented yet, and that was like, was it 1972, I think, The Exorcist was, or 74. So, that must have been like a godsend to people, that Steadicam.
You're absolutely right, because any handheld shots were just shaky and bouncy. No matter what you did, they were shaky and bouncy. There was no stabilization going on. Like, we in our brain, when we look at the world, we have natural stabilizers in our own heads that, like, if you nod your head up and down, you're still going to see a stabilized vision of the world. But a camera doesn't work that way. So you have to create this artificial, you know, device, which he managed to do. And it really did revolutionize, moving how a camera can move through a scene. And all of a sudden, we have an explosion of single take shots. We have the ability for more fluid shots and more interesting shots, which can move through a scene. And going back to the Shining one, what I love about that Shining one is the sense, first of all, the sense of the floating sense, right? So there's a sense of being a ghost, right? So you're kind of floating through this environment, which is really cool. But also, it manages to create a sense of drawing you into that space by being Danny's, kind of like Danny's your avatar in that big wheel. When he's cycling along, the sound of his wheels as it goes from boards to carpet to boards to carpet is kind of hypnotic, isn't it? And when you're going around the corners with him, there's, you know, it's almost like you're driving with him in a way. You're kind of like, you can see him oversteer at one moment, and you kind of want to say, oh, that's cool. You can actually feel the propulsion of it.
Yeah, but it's really transportive.
Drama. It's transportive. So you're kind of enjoying the momentum with him as he's enjoying the momentum. But when he turns that corner, and ahead of him is the two girls. And it was Garrett Brown who shot that. Garrett Brown shot that. And he said when he came around the corner. Yeah. A lot of people think that the cinematographers or the guys are doing all this sort of stuff. But it's the Steadicam operators are specific, like, you know, SWAT team guys that come in for Steadicam days.
Yeah, we had a Steadicam operator on Grabbers, and it's amazing that they'll come in, they'll take over those specific shots. So a lot of the stuff that was outside the bar with the ray machine going, and they're chasing people towards the police jeep and stuff, that was all the Steadicam operator.
And he would come in just for those shots, and he's specifically trained to use the Steadicam. You can't just pick up a camera and think you can use the Steadicam. There's a whole technique. It's like playing an instrument. What Garrett Brown said when he turned the corner and he saw those two twins, standing there, his hairs literally stood on his arms. He literally was freaked out by it himself in the moment, because he was with the kid as well, watching the kid through these viewfinders. So Yeah. It's an amazing, I love that long take. That's one of those takes that I actually do think is fantastic. And they employ it throughout the film, like, you know, chasing Danny when Danny's been chased by, you know, Jack Nicholson and stuff like that. It's damn cool.
Yeah, because like Steadicam sort of lends itself to those long takes, because it's like De Palma, obviously,
yeah,
has an amazing one at the start of Snake Eyes. Where, well, he's got loads, yes, of them throughout his career, but at the start of Snake Eyes, even though there are some hidden cuts in that, you know, where they pan across like TV monitors and what have you, but the scale of that, where you've got thousands and thousands of extras who, you know, imagine sort of doing a run through of that, and you've got to get all the timings right, and people sort of coming up to you and saying their lines, and you know, you're moving from one setup to the next setup and sort of keeping it all flowing. If you make any mistakes, having to go right back to one and start again. But I think it's like a 12-minute take at the start of Snake Eyes. And the film itself, you know, the film is the film. But that opening is like, when you think about doing a long take with a Steadicam shot, that is got to be up there with like Atonement, for like the massive scale of it, and the sort of the technical... what's the word? It's just, it's so sort of like jaw-dropping to watch.
I found a really interesting interview with the Steadicam operator of Atonement, and a bunch of stuff. Like, his name is Peter Robertson, and he gave a really interesting insight into the function and like the purpose of like using Steadicam in film. And he talks about, he would basically say, like, you know, first of all, you have to go through a whole school of Steadicam operation. But he said when he's been asked by a director and cinematographer, you know, to employ a Steadicam or use a Steadicam in a scene, he can book back and question, saying, well, why is this benefiting the story? Why do this in as one shot? And in the case of Atonement, and that was going to be one of the ones I have to mention, because even though I'm not like, you know, a huge fan of Atonement, I really admire it. And I really admire the long Steadicam shot in that.
It's more impressive to me than 1917, which is an entire movie that sort of like employs long takes and Steadicam.
Yeah,
that whole opening in Atonement, I think it's unreal.
And the reason, do you know why they did that in the Steadicam? Now, first of all, it's a nice stylistic thing. But in actual fact, like in the case of Orson Welles, it actually was cheaper. It actually turned, if they were to shoot that scene, like with locked off shots, you know, the extras would have increased, the sets they would have to build would increase. But instead,
were they
by
reusing extras then? Were they sort of like farming people from one section to the next section, depending on where they were pointing the camera? Was that sort of how it was cheaper?
No, not that. I think it was they literally had to build less. They literally kind of, because it was,
they
were going to create
the
same effect. Yeah, keep by having the point of view very, very specific, they were able to focus in on a much more isolated area, and rather than kind of like to create the same sense of immersion, if you know what I mean. So it was kind of like a cheat, but it was an incredibly long one. Like, you know, he walked, that trek for him was over a quarter of a mile. And the feat of actually pulling off the one in Shining, I'm sure everyone knows, it's like set after Dunkirk, and everything's gone to crap, and you've got soldiers wounded coming on the beach and all this sort of stuff. And we're following James McAvoy as he's coming up the beach. And basically, you know, to actually pull the shot off, Peter Robinson, the camera operator, said, I physically can't do this. I physically, they're heavy rigs to hold. And he said, I can't go. And he had to climb up sand.
A quarter of a mile.
You know what it's like.
Wow, fucking hell.
Yeah. But how they did it was they used different contraptions. So he would, for the sand, they had him on this like rickshaw thing. So he would like step onto the rickshaw and they'd pull him up right to the kind of like the far, as far up the sand they could. Then he would get off the rickshaw and he would like trudge up the sand. You know how it is to climb sand on your own, not in mind carrying a big piece of equipment like that. And then he would get onto the embankment where he goes and he does this, he kind of circles the soldiers who are singing, the Welsh soldiers who are singing that beautiful piece of music. And he walks around them, and then he gets onto another electric car and he gets pulled along as James McAvoy's been pulled along, walking along it, like, you know, behind him, we'll say, or behind him. And he gets off that. So there's all these transfers of his, like, it was, he said he actually...
I love those behind the scenes footage, tapes where they show you sort of the dance that goes on in order to sort of to pull off everything that they need in shot at that specific time, and sort of the transfer of jumping from one, you know, rig to the next rig and handing the camera over or stepping onto things and stepping off things. It's always so, like, incredible. It's like Cirque du Soleil stuff.
Yeah, that's an amazing one. It really is. Just behind, just the execution of that is so impressive. And I was just, I have such an appreciation for that craft and that ability. And again, the reason for doing it, you know, was one, I suppose, stylistically is quite nice. And he said it. He brought it. Peter Robson said it himself. He said some directors just see these shots as trophy shots. You know, as in, you know, just to kind of like be stylish, just for the sake of being stylish, rather than adding something to the story, you know? And in the case of The Shining, Kubrick employed it really well. Like, he drew us in, he kind of used it to kind of draw us into the world from the point of view of Danny. And it was really effective when, you know, something really abnormal and terrifying emerged in the world. But I think that one was really, I really liked the Atonement one. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, it's great. The one that I was also going to mention more. As like a backup to, if it wasn't going to be Halloween that you tipped me off on, I was going to mention like Children of Men, because Alfonso Cuarón has a lot of, he does a lot of sort of long takes as well. You know, Gravity, he's got that famous opening where it's all one take. But the one in the car where Julianne Moore, spoilers, if you've not seen it from, it's 2006, so I think people have seen it, where Julianne Moore gets killed. And the long take takes place in the actual car. And if you've ever seen how they've done that, it's remarkable. It's sort of like chairs will fold back and Julianne Moore will go flat and she'll be pulled out to the side and the camera, the whole roof will open up. And as the camera turns back around, Julianne Moore will slide back in on this little track and extend her seat upright again. So you think that, you know, it's like a trick shot as well as being like a long extended... unedited take. It's a really spectacular shot. So that was going to be like my backup one, but I don't know where your head was at with.
I love it. I love that one. Like, what you're describing there is like, it's that movie magic stuff, isn't it? It's the stuff where you go, it's like, Jesus, the execution of the trick is so impressive that you will watch the behind the scene making of.
I think it's on YouTube. You can look it up if anyone sort of is curious to see it. But just Google sort of how they did that shot and it'll show you this sort of like the orchestration that was involved. It's amazing.
And in the middle of that, Alfonso Cuarón, I think it took them 12 days to kind of get that done. And they finally almost got the shot they wanted. But when a significant character is shot, blood splattered off her squib and hit the lens, and Cuarón just went, screw it. Alfonso Cuarón showed it cut, like, you know, takes run. And the director of photography or the people just ignored him and they just kept rolling. And as a result, it ended up making the scene even more visceral and even more impactful, like, you know.
Yeah, it's been copied so many times now where they do sort of like the CGI blood on the screen. But yeah,
it's completely accidental.
Brilliant. I love that.
It's completely accidental. Yeah, it's fantastic. It really is. It's an amazing film. And
I dropped my phone and no, we can't edit that out.
I love it. I just hope you didn't drop it into a glass of water.
I made a list of like ones where I thought like, oh, just in case we skip over anything. But you know, we never prepped these episodes. We never know what the other person is going to say. So it's always like, you're always sort of wondering, do I jump in here? Or is this going to tread on their toes for later on? So the minute I said Children of Men, I thought, shit, maybe that's Will's pick. And I've just sort of fucked him over now.
No, it's not. I was glad you brought it up because I was looking at my list and I went, geez, I forgot to add it on my list. I was like, I'm so glad you brought it up, Kevin.
I'll mention another one I know that you won't bring this one up because I don't think you've seen it yet. But I mentioned on the Alan Smithy episode, The Vast of Night, from 2019. And that has so many long extended takes. And those ones are particularly impressive because it shows off the actors and how skilled they are at sort of just running and running and running with this dialogue that is so dense and so specific, and the language that they're using, and it immediately just brings you into the world where you don't feel like you're watching a film. You're sort of like transported right into that location and you're with those characters. But The Vast of Night from 2019 has got a great one. And another one, because we mentioned Halloween.
No, man. Go on.
But because Halloween was sort of famous for having that opening extended one-take shot, they tried to do one similar in the 2018 version. So they have that really long extended take where Michael Myers turns up on Halloween night and he sort of goes on a murder spree, sort of stalking around the Haddonfield borough, just killing everybody. And I think they shot that as well over the course of a few nights, and they did like 60 takes. So these things, like when they pull them off and you see them in a film, you just go with it, but you don't realize how long it takes to sort of like perfect them and to get them right. So there must be, you know, can you imagine? You're on like take 35 and you're thinking, shit, do we keep going? Have we got it? Because you can't hide it. Maybe we can get it right on the next one. Nope. Take 42. Oh, fuck, man. This is never going to work. We're going to have to cut it from the schedule. So that's the confidence of a director and a production where they're like, no, we're doing this. We're going to get it right. Let's keep going.
Yeah.
And then we see the version which is like the one that has the fewest mistakes in it. But I love the pure cinema, because it's like it's all about the whole team working as one to sort of bring off this amazing sort of moment that you don't realize in most cases that it's all happened in front of you in one take.
Yeah, just like this podcast. It's all like, this is literally just evolving. It's just one take.
No mistakes.
And it's really lovely. But, you know, you lead me on to another, because I'm trying to go through my honourable mentions. There's no rhyme or reason, but basically I'm following the flow of conversation. And one that popped into my head that only became possible, again, was due to the evolution of technology. And it was from 2002, I believe, and it's a film, Russian Ark, right? So made by Alexander Surikov. And it was basically before the early 2000s, it really wouldn't have been possible because of film stock. Because as we already mentioned with Alfred Hitchcock, you could only shoot for 10 minutes and they would have to do, you know, imaginary cuts. But what we had in the early 2000s was the evolution of digital cameras. And as a result, they were able to go for, you know, almost not an infinite take, but they could basically shoot for 100 minutes before the memory of the camera would be full. That's a fact. So they knew they had 100 minutes, right? And what Russian Ark is basically a film that's set in a museum in, can't remember actually what museum it is, but it's you follow a ghost as he takes you through this museum, which basically flows through 300 years of Russian history. And it is amazing. It is amazing.
Wow,
it is
that all does sound amazing.
Live in one take. It's beautiful. It's like watching Barry Lyndon, you know, a one take Barry Lyndon almost going where you have people like big ballroom scenes and there's lots of music and it's very simple, like, you know, but it's beautiful and breathtaking to behold. And you were talking about mistakes. And the one thing they did because it's set in this museum, they only had 3 days to actually set up the shots. Because the museum was an open and active museum. So literally they closed the museum and the entire team had to come in and set the whole place up for one night of shooting. And they had to like build the sets and wire the lights and wire everything and have the costumes all ready and have I think it was something like 2,000 extras. 2,000 extras.
Wow.
Yeah. Had to come together to make all of these set pieces work. Like, we're talking big. It's not like a small, intimate, like two people in a room sort of stuff.
It's like a flash ballroom period.
Oh, it's amazing. It really is. Just to watch it as an execution, it's amazing. But the one trick that they had to pull off. Go on.
Keep going. Because I was just going to mention, keep going, and then I start talking. No, in Hard-Boiled, okay. Hard-Boiled, the hospital yeah. sequence where they go into the elevator, and you think as you're watching it, or I think as I'm watching it, that the elevator's gone up a level. But because, yeah. you know, there's a big shootout that happens, they go into the elevator, they're arguing with each other, they're loading up, the doors open, and it's obviously a different level, and they start firing and shooting up there. But it's not, it's the same, it's a stage. So as the doors close, all the crew run in, and they start pulling out walls and swapping, moving in furniture to make it look like the elevator's landed on a different floor. So it's that stuff. There was an amazing Spike Jones commercial that I can't remember the yeah. name of it now, but if you look up Spike Jones sort of one-take commercials, all the trick shots that they do, like the Weezer, the Weezer music videos, all the sort of the Rube Goldberg machine type thing that they do, all the sort of like, all done in one. It's that sort of stuff on a film set. But you're saying Russian Ark has that on a spectacularly huge scale.
And there is another thing I want to say about Russian Ark. Oh, the elevator thing in Hard-Boiled, the elevator doors were only closed for 20 seconds. So the crew had 20 seconds to clean up the set. It was amazing. I would say it would have been easier to just build a lift and build a second floor and build a second set. I don't know why they didn't do that.
It reminds me of that moment in Poltergeist where the mother is sort of just chatting to the kid over the breakfast, I think, as everyone else has gone to school and gone to work. And the camera just stays on her as she goes and takes something out of a drawer, and she looks back, and suddenly all the chairs in the kitchen are stood on the table. And it's another thing of like just in the 3 seconds it took for the camera to pan across and then pan back, like 16 crew members just ran in and meticulously sort of like built the chairs on top of the... Oh no, I think all the chairs were stuck together. So they just all ran in and just put the chair on top of the table. But everyone else had to remove the chairs that were there.
Brilliant.
If you were to hear the actual sound, it's like, go! And it's like feet scrambling and doors slamming and move, move, move. And I love that stuff.
And that's isn't the effect of that is far more effective than a simple cut. And a simple turnaround cut. You know, that was because you know it's one continuous shot. You the impact of that is, it's terrifying. Because
they do that?
Yeah, and also from an audience point of view, you're in there going, I was over here, I was just there with her. I was just over there. We went to the thing and we turned around. There was no cut and it happened. You almost kind of feel like a ghost did actually capture it. That's how how you can really pull off ghost stuff is by actually pulling that trickery off in camera without cuts and all that sort of stuff. And actually, I think that's when it's really, really effective.
Definitely.
Oh, my point about the Russian Ark was that the only trickery they pulled with Russian Ark is that they didn't record the sound live. And the reason they didn't record the sound live was chaos. Because the director was swearing so much and there was so much chaos. They were literally shouting at each other, you go over here, shut the fuck up, you get over there. He was literally screaming at everyone. So they basically ADR'd or did all the post sound and post, like, you know. But everything else is shot, like, in the floor.
David Fincher does that as well, though. Like, he's got one in Panic Room. But, you know, he ADRs all of his films at this point. He does everything in post-production and he stabilizes the camera. He does all these sort of like little tricks that people don't realize are being done. But yeah, he doesn't believe in... Well, I shouldn't say things as factual statements when I'm just sort of passing off hearsay. But I think prefers to do all of the dialogue in post to ADR it, essentially. Because he prefers the sound quality. But he's a perfectionist, so... Yeah, Panic Room's got one. But
that was one I was going to mention as well. There's another one I wanted...
Can I...
Yeah?
Go... Well, we mentioned Protector, didn't we? In the fight scenes episode.
Yes,
which is one long Steadicam shot, which is a great one to watch.
In researching this, I learned that they fired the first three Steadicam operators because they couldn't keep up with the action. They literally were exhausted. Yeah, they got on the third one they hired was the guy who could keep up with the pace. So that's
the
a
speed
that was
of
one
Tony
on my long list. Yeah, it's amazing. That's an amazing one. I was going to mention The Player by Robert Altman's The Player,
yeah,
which opens with a long, long, long take. And the meta thing for this episode is that in it, one of the characters actually talks about Orson Welles' Touch of Evil opening with that's a 7-minute long take, or 5 minutes. I don't know. It's a long one, you know?
But you know, and what? I read slowly on that when I was looking it up. Someone said, or someone wrote that all the dialogue in that opening was ad-libbed. So people were just ad-libbing moments.
I learned that too. Yeah, completely improvised dialogue. But the most important thing about that is that we're flowing through. Again, it's the movement going through this backlot scenario where you get to feel the artifice of how nice and beautiful and California and sunny it all is. But as you get closer into the meetings and Tim Robbins, the horrible pitches and then the graduate too. And like, he's literally pitching. Is that the one where he can pitch any headline from a newspaper and turn it into a movie? Who needs writers? That's basically what it is. And yep, there's a poor writer in with him trying to pitch to him. That was the one that broke my heart. This writer, okay, I've got this. And he's like just pitching his heart out, like, you know, for all these different, you know, and the exec is Timmy Robbins is just literally just going, yeah, whatever.
Can I tell you just as an aside that when I was an intern in LA, I used to have to sit in on meetings. I think just as work experience, and I'm not going to say where, but it's a producer that won an Academy Award. And they were having writers come in to pitch on a rewrite. And the producer would throw out these terrible suggestions. And, you know, I was sitting there over the course of like 3 or 4 days watching all these different writers come in. And they don't know who you are. Obviously, they're looking around the room for sort of friendly eyes. And I am, you know, pretending to to be an ally in the room when really I had no power whatsoever. I was there to get water and get coffee and what have you. But the producer would throw out terrible ideas and just to see how they'd respond to the suggestion that he was making. And afterwards, people, you know, there'd be some of them that would say, that's a great idea. We could do this, we could do that. And then there'd be others that would say, I'm not sure about that because what we could do instead. But no matter what they said, and this was the scary thing for me, you know, when I started to write myself, was that if they agreed with him, he thought they had no spine. And if they disagreed with him, he thought that they were too intractable in their beliefs and they would be difficult to work with. So it was a lose-lose scenario. Okay. And I thought, why is he playing these fucking mind games with people? But The Player was a very good satirical take on
close to home.
Yeah.
But you know what the satisfying thing about that opening shot of The Player?
Well, we cut all that out.
Well, the satisfying thing about The Player is that when we get to the very end of that final shot, you're on a kind of a close-up through the window, and Tim Robbins' character has got a postcard in his hand, and it's a death threat, or, you know, a kind of a death threat. And you go, it ends with intrigue. It's not just a kind of a moving shot for the sake of a moving, or like a long take for the sake of a long. It ends, it draws you into the world, and it ends with a point of like, you know, there's a death threat is afoot. And again, it's intriguing. It's intriguing. And they're great ways of like us bringing you into an environment, introducing you to this kind of space, you know, and it's really, really cool. There's other ones. Oh, yeah. Well, of course, we have to talk about Paul Thomas Anderson and Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Of course, that's one that has to be
mentioned. Which one in Boogie Nights do you like? Because there are two really brilliant ones in Boogie Nights.
The second one.
Yeah. See, I was going to say the second one as well, but that opening as well.
Yeah.
With that great music and you're just sort of like following Roller Girl and you're meeting all the cast. What a audacious way to open a movie. I love it.
Yeah, and the second one then is basically we're at a party and the party's really fun, but we start following William H. Macy's character, who's a, you know, a cuckold's husband. And it's a New Year's party, I can't quite remember right now, but everything is going fun. And he opens the door of a bedroom and he finds his wife, you know, having sex. And he doesn't react. He just turns around and he walks out to the car.
Isn't she a real porn star as well? Or she was a porn star? I'm pretty sure she was a... She was an actual porn star.
Quite possibly, I don't know. But that's just, you know, it was an amazing one because I never watched porn. You just make it.
That's what the review said.
But what's really affecting
long take.
Yeah, it's when we follow him. We follow him out, and he gets a gun, goes in, and emotionlessly, you know, shoots them both, and it really shatters this, you know, the space of this party. You feel like you're at, you. That's the effect.
The whole movie takes
shots,
a turn.
You feel like
it?
You're in the space. The whole thing kind of pivots at that moment, like, you know. So I think that's the one that really stood out to me from that film.
Yeah. So we've mentioned Kubrick, De Palma, Cuaron.
Yeah.
Who else is there? Orson Welles.
Anderson. Orson Welles.
Hitchcock.
Yeah.
I think there's one. Because we sort of we're very much like Hollywood junkies. We love all the Western cinema. Tarkovsky obviously had some great ones. Godard did
beautiful
as well.
One.
In The Weekend.
Yeah.
But
Tarkovsky's in the Mirror.
Yeah. Those are amazing as well, just for, like, you know, it feels like you're seeing money actually being burned, literally being burned on camera, and you wonder, like, if they don't get that right, they're going to have to, and they did, in some instances, have to sort of rebuild the actual barn or the house or what have you, and set fire to it again. But I think there's
incredible.
One... It is. I think there's one name that we haven't mentioned.
That's going to be my best bit. Yeah, we're coming to it, and it's my best bit, right? And it's got to be the Copacabana shot in Goodfellas, and that is my best bit. And I have got things to say because I learned stuff about this that just opened my eyes, and I was like, "Wow, that's fascinating."
I know one little thing about it, but I remember that shot being shown to us in college as sort of like an amazing Steadicam moment. And it still holds up. 1990, you'd think that Goodfellas was like mid to late 90s, but 1990, it's such a timeless film.
And it's only a short 7 years later, Paul Thomas Anderson is homaging him in Boogie Nights with the same type of shot.
Definitely.
And of course, it's everyone knows it's the shot where Henry Hill is taking his wife, Karen, played by Lorraine Blanco.
Lorraine Blanco, the therapist from Sopranos.
He's taken her on her first proper date because their first date was a disaster, and he truly wants to try and win her over, and he basically goes into the hottest nightclub, the Coca Cabana, not through the front door but down through the basement and in through the, he tips everyone along the way and in through the kitchen where he knows all the staff, and he emerges on the main floor where the show is in full swing, and he tips another guy, and the other guy, you know, clicks his fingers, and a waiter comes forward with a table with the tablecloth just floating off it like a cape, and places it right up the front, right in front of the comedian, and the comedian like winks and nods to Henry Hill, and Lorraine Blanco at that moment sits beside him, and she says, "What do you do again?" And you know that she's in love. You know, and of course the soundtrack is amazing at that moment as well.
But
and it is an utterly amazing shot. It really is.
What
are the things you want to say about that?
I don't know if you know it as well, but once it gets pointed out to you, it kind of like fucks with your head a little bit. So every time I rewatch Goodfellas, and it is like one of the most rewatchable films ever, but now every time I watch that shot, after being told that they go, the way that they come in is also the way that they go out as they walk into the kitchen, that they actually just do a 360 and they come right back to the same door. That when you watch it, you're thinking, like, what the fuck are they doing? Like, they could have just kept going straight, but no, they go in, they go left, they go right, they go right, they go right, they go right, they go left. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
But you're so sort of caught up by all the sort of, like, the chaos of the kitchen and all that's going on and all the sort of, like, asides where he's showing off by tipping people and what have you. You don't notice it on a first watch.
You don't. And I loved the genesis of this, because this shot wasn't intended to go that way. The reason they went and did this was because they actually weren't allowed to shoot going through the main door of the Coco Cabana. So they actually had to go down that way. Yeah, this is what happened. So they had to go. They had to figure out, says, well, what way do we go in? And they said, well, he's going to, because in the book, it just kind of like glosses over it and says, yeah, we greased a lot of pans and yada, yada. In the script, there's about one page dedicated to it. But then the actual execution of it was not the cinematographer. The cinematographer was the one who said, oh, Marty, we have to go into the kitchen. We have to, because all they were going to do was just go down the bottom and walk straight through that corridor and go straight onto the main floor. But it was the cinematographer who came in and he just went, look at the kitchen, look at the light. We have to come into the light. And so what he did was when he was so right. But then, so that's the cinematographer. And, the cinematographer was great. But the cinematographer isn't the guy who actually pulled it off. The people who pulled it off were Larry McConkie, the Steadicam operator, and Ray Liotta. They were the ones who choreographed it, because he was the one who had to, everything, it's not Scorsese, it's not even the cinematographer, it's Larry McConkie, a name you'll probably never knew it was attached to Goodfellas. He was the guy who basically said, figured out, okay, I'm on the Steadicam, Ray, when you go down the stairs, I need you to slow up when you go down the stairs. And Ray Liotta had the idea. He says, well, if we put a guy at the door downstairs, I can just kind of like grease his pan. And so that's why he greases so many pans. It's so the Steadicam cam operator can catch up to him.
Or this is why cinema is a collaborative art form. Because it's everybody working in concert. And some of the best ideas are by the people whose names will never get remembered. Or brought up. But yeah. And it's such a great moment.
Listen to this. What's amazing about it is that even when they go in through the corridor, they see a couple kissing. The reason that happened was because Larry McConkie says to Ray Liotta, Ray, I gotta see your face. What can we do so you can turn to me? And he says, well, Ray Liotta says, if there's a couple here making out, maybe I'll turn around and I can engage with them. And so when they went into the kitchen, they had to make it look, because they were just effectively going to do a lap at the kitchen and come out the same door. But what they did is when they went into the kitchen, the set decorators were behind them and they changed the kind of like dressing on the doorway. So it made it look like it was a different doorway. And they come out onto the floor and they basically, it is in the script. And what happened was they recorded this, like they did a rehearsal of it and they showed it to Scorsese, and Scorsese and Larry McConkie thought, oh, this is all shoe leather. This is going to get fucking chopped. And he kind of had his head in his hands thinking, oh, look, that's that job wasted. So Scorsese watches it and it finishes and Scorsese goes, no, 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 no. And Larry McConkie's going, oh, God, I'm fired, I'm fired, I'm fired. And Scorsese says, no, at the end, the waiter's got to come in with the table and hold it right over his head and walk across the floor like it's gliding, because that happened to me. I was a guy who was at the front of the stage and they came in and it was just Goodfellas put tables in front of me and tables in front of me, and before I knew it, I was at the back of the stage, you know? He used to think he could have a seat at the front. Other than that, he was perfect. And they shot that 9 times, right? They shot it 9 times and they got it. Ray Liotta and Larry McConkie got it right every time. But do you know why they had to redo it 9 times? The reason being is because, remember, there's a stand-up guy on the stage that they go to and he says, take my wife, please. No, take her, or whatever he says.
Yeah.
He kept fluffing his lines. They had to redo the whole thing because of him, and they couldn't digitally screw it up. Larry McConkie and Goodfellas, you know, that's the guy. Not Scorsese, Larry McConkie. That's the guy.
There we go.
But also,
and that's I want to give hour.
That's 1 hour done. But hey, I also want to champion Gareth Brown, the inventor of the Steadicam, who Gareth Brown went on to He revolutionized how we watch sports today, because he is, if you watch any sporting match, do you know those Sky cameras over a football match? He invented those. He invented a camera that goes down with divers at the Olympics. He basically invented a camera for each sport in the Olympics, any professional sport, Gareth Brown invented. Yeah, he was an amazing dude. And he shot physically, he was the guy who shot the, in Return of the Jedi. Return of the Jedi, the going through
Never
Ender, the speeder chase scene in Ender. Never seen it. But there's, you should see it. It's Star Wars, right? You should check it out. It's really interesting. It might be up your alley. But there's an Ender speeder chase scene.
I'll make
that's
it
all
so.
Steadicam. That was Gareth Brown. There was, he did.
That wasn't Gareth Brown. That was all rear projection. Don't lie to me, though. That was, they weren't actually, you know, on another speeder bike going at like 150 miles an hour.
when they were doing the going through the woods, he was the one carrying the bloody camera going through the woods. And he was there on Temple of Doom. He was on the rope bridge on Temple of Doom with his steady camera.
God.
Yeah.
You couldn't have paid me to have walked out on that bridge. Forget it.
He said he had to run across it, and he said it was, you know, to excuse the pun, it was ropey.
actually, in this economy,
guy.
You probably could pay me to do it.
A fascinating guy. But Kevin, yes, that is over an hour of us unedited chat about one take shots.
Did you do okay?
Well done, Larry
McConkey.
For
our final episode? I thought that was all right. Usually this would get chopped down to like, and he'd come out with like a 40-minute episode. But this is it's the end of season one, isn't it? Is it?
It's the end of season one. What do you mean? I thought we were burning the wheel. I thought the wheel was going to be put in the closet, and that was it.
It turns out we don't need the wheel for the end of this episode. Because you can tell them, Will, what have we got?
Because our now new friends at the wonderful, fun film podcast Clash of the Titles have reached out to us and challenged us to come up with an episode based on a topic that they have selected. So I think it's just the easiest thing to play that clip and let them speak for themselves.
Hello, Kevin and Will. Chris, Vicky and Alex here from Clash of the Titles. Big fans of the show and truly honoured that you are dropping the best bit spinning wheel for 1 week and allowing us to choose your category. After hours of discussion and debate, we've decided on best robot scene. But team, what should that include? Alex, do cyborgs, androids, synthetics and replicants all count?
Yes, I'm going to say yes. I think, you know, let's throw a lot into the mix here. I mean, I want Bishop from Aliens to be considered. I want Rutger Hauer in Blade Runner as an option. So, yeah, the replicant there, synthetic there. So, cool. Yeah.
Vicky, as someone who won't use home tech and isn't a fan of Alexa, does AI count?
No, because I don't know what that means.
Okay, AI does count. you mentioned a couple of specific scenes you'd like to hear, see.
I absolutely want one of the most terrifying robots in cinema history for me, based on the fact that I watched it when I was quite young, but it's so scary, the scene, and it's such a scary robot, and I want some discussion about Ed 209 in the original RoboCop.
And you know what? They've already mentioned talk of Ed 209 in their practical effects episode, but we want more RoboCop and more Ed 209. Vicky?
I really think we should talk about Short Circuit 2.
Obviously.
When Johnny Five gets smashed to bits. Because when you asked me this, that's just where my mind went straight away, and then I nearly started crying. So okay. I would like to see... I've buried that, actually. I'd only just remembered that scene.
Why not, if we're doing AI, which it sounds like we are, including...
It's not us doing it.
I mean, I know what I was doing. Death, you Demon Seed.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
I can't believe you said that.
I went there.
But speaking of horrible things, the guys have already spoken about Superman 3 robot that scared the proverbial out of me on their Questionable Scenes for Kids episode. So the only one I'd want to add to the list is the shit robot from the start of Rocky 4.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so we've picked a lot of shit here. So obviously, guys, feel free to ignore these suggestions. It's your podcast rather than ours. But thanks again for letting us choose the category, and good luck picking your best robot scene.
So there we have it. We are being dragged back by the good people of Clash of the Titles, Chris, Alex and Vicky, for one more round. Just when we thought we were done and too old for this shit, they pull us back in. And why specifically did they pick robot scene, Kevin?
Because they're doing, as next week's episode, they're doing Terminator versus Terminator 2. Now, I don't know how you possibly pick which is the better of those two films, but they've tasked us with coming up with the best robot scene. So, you know, we've got cyborgs, synthesoids, droids, replicants. We've got friendly robots, evil robots. We've got a lot of choice there. So we're gonna tackle that. So that'll be our final episode. Oh, thanks to Clash of the Titles, which, you know, is definitely worth subscribing to. So yeah, we're back next week for our actual final episode, which will be Best Robot Scene, and then we're off for the summer holidays.
Kevin, I've literally just burned my film encyclopedias. They're literally, you can see the bonfire is, happening out the back right now. I've pulled the fire alarm in the house, you know, in our temple. And, I don't want to be called into the principal's office. Oh, God. This is going to be awkward when I have to come back in. But it's great. I'm delighted. It's so, this is so exciting, you know, to be doing this. With them, and I can't wait to hear what they say about Terminator and Terminator 2, because how do you separate them?
I'm afraid that I would have to go with Terminator for that, just because it was the first one, and I think that always what comes first should come out on top, regardless of whether it gets perfected later on. That's just my personal preference, even though I probably like Terminator 2 more, but I would, in that scenario, I would go with Terminator.
I'm going Terminator 2. Sorry. It's amazing. I have to leave it with that. Okay.
So, yeah. So, next week we'll be back for episode 17, the end of season 1, Best Robot Scene. Yeah. So, we'll see you then.
And don't forget to do all our...
forgot all that. You can cut
where,
this in
Kevin?
There. Like, subscribe, Kevin. Share, email us, follow me, Kevin Lee Han, on Twitter. Yeah.
Willems Film, Twitter, Best Bits Pod, email bestbitspod@gmail.com.
Five stars.
Yeah. Five stars, that's the only way to go. And thanks so much for listening. And we'll say our proper, goodbye, for the season next week. But great. I'm looking forward to it. A proper edited, not just a one take, one hit wonder, properly edited show next week. Cool.
Okay, back to one. We got to do this whole episode again.
Did I fluff my line at the very end? God damn it. I fluffed the last bit. Just like that goddamn comedian in Goodfellas. God damn it.
The Best Bits podcast is produced by Will and Kevin.
All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, rate, review. All that good stuff.
If you have any notes, comments, scene suggestions, or just want to get in touch with us, email us at bestbitspodcast@gmail.com.
And here is a clip from the lads' latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Mini Bits.
Another new episode.
Tuck-a-dee, stupid
clips. Patreon podcast.
Of this Patreon podcast. Exclusive.
The Best Bits Podcast with Will and Ken. Bonus content for you, yeah. That's right, this is for you. Not for them, just for you. The Best Bits Podcast with Will and Ken. Exclusive content. You're on the Talking Films and Shows.
Kevin, how are you?
Hi, honey. How are you?
Oh, I've got this. I've got my corns sorted out. I went to the chiropodist the other day, and she
Your
said,
"Corn,
my corns. Did you ever get corns?
No.
Did you know what a corn is?
Yeah, it's a bunion on your foot, isn't it?
Yeah, like in between your toes and stuff like that.
Do you not wear any shoes like around the house? You walk
no,
barefoot.
I wear no. It's the opposite.
GA shorts.
It's the opposite. I wear incredibly tight shoes. Like those Chinese women who get their feet bound, who had their feet bound, before the turn of this last century. And so they had incredible corns and bunions. This is a great opener for a Mini Bits episode where we get people disgusted.
Squally, it's episode 73 of the Mini Bits. I'm Kevin, you're Will. This is our Patreon podcast. Thank you to all our lovely patrons. Yeah. A few of you have jumped in recently. I don't know what we said. We try to goad people into joining up every single episode, and then every so often it's like a lot of people join because of one specific episode, and I'm like, How did we say it? What did we say in that episode? It's different to the other 270 episodes.
Maybe it didn't sound as desperate. Maybe we said, don't join. Maybe reverse psychology. That's how we should do it. Reverse psychology. Don't join up to our patron. Don't.
Cancel. You don't everybody cancel.
You don't deserve to be in this group. We don't want you. We don't like the look of you.
We don't need anybody.
It's just us. It's absolutely just us. Hey, should we tell you, we did, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't say it on mic, especially so early. We did an interview with the Irish Examiner last Friday.
We did.
Yeah.
And
how do you think I did?
I think you did all right. Like, you didn't interrupt me once, so I was delighted with how I came across. But, you know, there's no sort of time limit on this. We don't know when it's going to get posted. One of our friends was saying, Kathy at the cinema was saying that their interview with, did they do the Examiner as well? It was six months before it posted.
And the Guardian, I'm pretty sure. They were profiled in the Guardian as well.
Yeah, but we don't do any really promotion. Like, we don't do anything.
Well, this is our first time getting any sort of like proper coverage, which is going to be mad. So listen to all you listeners who have found us before we explode. You're an OG. You're an OG listener before Kevin starts getting gold chains from all his Patreon dash.
I think I'm more of a silver than a gold. I think my undertones suit more silver. But
I just want to
die. Goes with Prince Albert.
Your hat?
Yeah.
I want one of those diamond studs in my tooth. That's all I want. So I can go bing whenever I'm on a call.
Oh, yeah.
Bing.
I usually just, you know, wink and that glints.
Yeah.
Like a starlight twinkle.
Speaking of which, I interrupted you. What did you want to speak of? Which?
Start the timer.
Oh! I forgot.
You may as well.
Start the timer.
All these lucky losers are listening in and they're wondering, what are we going to be talking about? But we have to start talking about them after.
Yeah.
We say goodbye. But look, I wanted to talk to you about, you've seen a few things. You've seen the new Godzilla film.
Yes.
I've seen the first Omen. I saw Scoop as well.
We're looking Netflix forward to watching this. We already see, okay.
Okay. I'll save my thoughts. And what else did I see? I made notes, but sure, it doesn't really matter.
I think I saw that.
And I was going to go through all the summer releases and see what takes your fancy.
Okay. I'm looking forward because I don't actually know what's on the horizon. So
the Joker 2 trailer came out today.
I saw it. Yes, I watched that.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of Chicago.
Yeah, it's kind of like you see it's all very much in the mind's eye. They're calling it a jukebox musical. Am I right in saying that?
I think you're right in saying that.
So, look, hey, listen. What it did remind me of was that I want to rewatch The Joker because I saw it in the cinema and I thought it was fine. It was kind of a bold new direction.
I'm just going to go back and watch the episodes from the Batman 66 show, the Joker episodes.
Oh, yeah, that's going
to
be...
Just to fill me in, like, on the lore. You know, get up to speed.
Get you right up to speed. And you'll be there going, where are all the guys in the purple suits with the masks? When are they going to show up? And like,
it's a bit of a weird time though, where we have the Penguin TV show with Colin Farrell coming out, which is a totally different canon version of the Penguin. Then you have this offshoot of Joker, which is in its own universe entirely.
Mm.
And then you have the old Batman films that you can watch.
Right.
And, I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's just, I don't know. I'm kind There's of so many IP.
But like,
it's just everywhere.
What's happened is the comic book world has very much entered the film world. It's where you could have different runs, totally different runs of a character by different authors. And there would be totally different riffs on it and stuff. Oh, this is the thing. Kevin, so I'm only catching up on this. You mentioned it to me on a podcast. Was it on one of those?
It was the last mini bits.
You said everyone's describing stuff as insane recently.
And have you started noticing it though?
Only with people trying to rise you. That's the only place where I've noticed people on Discord are trying to rise you.
Oh my god! Oh my god! I could start posting now, like, tweets, comments, TikToks. Articles, anything. Insane is everywhere. This is insane. That's insane. It's insane. There was a festival just going on about this insane lineup. Okay. I was like, oh, it's a mentally ill lineup. Okay. It's just, it's everywhere. And the other, the other thing that's also bothering me lately?
What?
And this has been bothering me for years and years and years. It used to be that everyone used to misspell definitely. They'd go defiantly.
Okay.
Oh, it's defiantly whatever. They would just, they're morons. But no, I just keep noticing everyone keeps spelling a lot as one word. A-L-O-T, a lot. Where have they gotten into their heads that a lot is one word? It's the same way that people will write every time as one word.
What's the one that you've pulled me up on a few times and I can't get it right? Compliment.
Compliment.
I can't, but I can't get it right. It's like the
I. You can, because I told you the other day.
Yeah, and I went searching for it and I couldn't find it because I had to actually had to use it.
If there's an I in compliment, it's I'm paying you a compliment.
That's a good way to remember it. Okay, good. And then compliment.
I wrote that to you.
But you did, and I went to try and find it because I found myself writing the word compliment. And I went, shit, Kevin.
But you gave me a thumbs up, which meant in my world that, yeah, I read that. Thanks.
But I did, right? I'm talking about a couple of days later when I was faced with the exact same hurdle of writing the word compliment. I went, okay, what did Kevin say again about compliment? There's an I and the E. What did he say? So I went searching for it and I found it, I think. And I went, oh, the I is paying me a compliment, or I'm giving you
a compliment. It's insane how little you can retain information. It's insane.
Come here, let's start talking about what we watched. Come on.
Did you start the timer?
Yeah, it's gone. It's ticking. It's ticking down. The world's going to explode.
Do you know, I have to put in the sound effect. I have to line up all my sound effects.
When you said start the timer,
I have a whole soundboard here.
Okay.
Jesus Christ, where's my fucking
what?
Where's my ding dang ding?
Here we go. The timer has started. There we go.
There we go. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Right.